Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Good evening, this is Terry Dodd, and this is Walls in Our Minds. We are here for another really awesome show tonight. We're doing a follow-up to our show last week. We started out talking about common law, and we really just got warmed up a little bit. And we've asked Gus Breton and some of his associates to join us again this evening. And Gus, if you're there, please open us with a prayer.
Thank you, Terry. Can you hear me?
Hear you just fine.
All right, thank you. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity to reach out to people around the country, give them some good news, something that they can use to make life a whole lot simpler. It's a pretty incredible responsibility to get accurate information out there, and I'm hoping that you're going to have your hand in this and guide me through the whole thing, and people who are should be looking to you and looking inside and feeling their way through things and paying attention to that peace that's within and let that peace guide them, because stuff we're talking about really comes from the inside. It's not something you you learn to mimic, or, you know, there's no magic words. So help us all to reach inside and feel the guidance. And And thanks for being with us tonight. Amen.
Thanks for handling that duty. We try to make it a tradition here at Walls in Our Minds to always open it with a prayer. And I'll tell you, the shows that we've forgotten to do that have, well, it's been pretty evident. There's been a number of times that we should have been praying before the show started because of the technical things we've had with BTR. But Gus, just I really appreciate your availability and making yourself available. I see this as a spiritual battle that we're in, and I guess when people ask me, you know, what can we do, what can I do, the number one thing they can do is make themselves available, and you're always available, and I know that a lot of the folks that rely on you for their chat and their conversations and just trying to share things with each other, really appreciate how available you are. And I know that our Father in Heaven, that's a big key to him too. I think that's what he loved about David so much. Last week, you know, we really didn't get too much into the big picture. We focused a lot on the smaller stuff. And I'd kind of like to suggest here at the beginning of this show that common law is all about the pecking order that we talk about so much here on Walls in Our Minds. You know, Red Beckman, who will be joining us here in just a few minutes, I'm watching the switchboard to see when Red comes on, but he was running a little late getting into the house and getting something in his stomach. His health, he's been struggling a little bit lately. He's had a few falls, but he always brings us back to that. You know, he puts his compass on that spiritual battle and that pecking order, and he tries to keep us online here. And it's really an important thing for us to focus on, and no matter what we're talking about. But this concept of our Creator and him being the one that gave us our unalienable rights, if it wasn't for the Ten Commandments, I think, you know, not just the Ten Commandments, but all of his commandments, all of his right rulings, really is the basis of common law. Would you agree with that?
I certainly would. It's you know, there's a lot of different writings out there, different religions, and you know, they all have a lot of similarity. But definitely, you know, for us, that's where we look to, and the you know, it just happens to be that we're living in a country that founded its law system on the Judeo-Christian view of life, on forgiveness, and absolutely, Terry. You know, there's over 600 statutes in the Bible, and they give a lot of direction on where to go, what not to do, having respect for your fellow man and for the people around you. And if Carl gets a chance to come on here, this is something that I really picked up. One of the first things I picked up when I was hanging out with Carl is that, and he says it a lot, that if you don't know that God is there, if you don't know that, then you will never have the potential to be the man that you're supposed to be, because only when you know that you were created will you ever know that you have authority to do and be what you're supposed to do and be. And without that, you're gonna get run around. The system's gonna run you around. They're gonna know that you don't know. So I hope he has a chance to talk about that with you sometime.
Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the big picture here before we get launched back into talking about things like how to move a claim, your claim in a court, which I believe really is something that I hope Carl will come on and talk about a little bit, because I believe he's probably been most articulate about that, and it's really important. But before, when we were talking about the importance of acting as a man, one of the things that you brought out, and I believe you have it on your website and some of those frequently asked questions and some of your answers, is that there's no higher status for a human being than the man created in the image of his creator.
That's correct.
Would you?
Well, it comes back to what I was just saying. When you know that you are created in the image of God, then you know that you cannot be judged by the system. The system cannot judge you because you are its creator, no more than you can judge God. And only the other people that are created in the image of God can judge you. And they represent, you know, the society that you're in. So, go ahead.
Red Beckman has joined us and does have a live mic. Red, would you just like to say hello to Gus? Probably got a muted phone there. Might be still chewing on his supper.
Yeah. Do you hear me now?
We hear you.
Very good. You know, I really appreciate the words that I've heard here. I think that we have to have a real focus in what we're trying to do. There's millions of our fellow Americans out there that have absolutely no clue, and they are not taught in their homes or churches or their schools or major media or anything else, you know, about the common law and the fact that we are creatures created in the likeness of our Heavenly Father. You know, we're going to have to do a better job, I think, become more focused on reaching out to our fellow Americans with the message. I like to remind people that, and I've done that before on our programs on Thursday night, and not as much as I probably should have, the fact that The junk heaps of history are piled high with governments. And the Roman Empire is there. It was a great empire. And, of course, history records the rise and fall of many kingdoms and empires. And we even have a contemporary story of most of us in our lifetime have witnessed the fall of the USSR in December of 91. And so we need to stress the fact that we the people survived the fall of the Roman Empire. We survived the fall of all of those kingdoms and empires in history, and we survived. The people of Russia have done a fantastic job of surviving in the fall of the USSR. And so we have to stress the fact that governments are not eternal. They have a tendency to self-destruct. And so if we can get that message across to people, and the fact that we the people are the ones created the Magna Carta in 1215 A.D. King John was such an outlaw, and he had the people reduced to a feudal state, and the Magna Carta was written by people outside of government, and this is what we have to really get across to our fellow Americans, is that the common law is not, it was not created by governments, because these governments come and go. Common law was written by the survivors of government mischief and terrorism and misgovernment and all of that. And so in 1776, the Declaration of Independence, it was not created by Parliament over there in London, England, which was supposedly the governing body of we the people. And the King George III, of course, was an outlaw. But we the people were the ones that created that document. And it was we the people who created the Articles of Confederation. It was those the Articles of Confederation were not created by the English Parliament. It was created by we the people in this country. And that goes for the Constitution of 1787, goes for the Bill of Rights. And so we have to use this background and this information to get people to understand the importance of the common law and the fact that any law written by government, Congress, senators, representatives, the courts, the executive branch, any law that those people calling themselves government, any law that they create is inferior to the law that we the people wrote. And I tell you, that just gives me a thrill every time I think of it, how that we have been so programmed to believe that, you know, that the common law is something that came out of the trash heap of history or something. The common law is very much alive today, and I can assure you that there's some common law that is being put to use right now as we speak and as we try to learn and learn how to use the common law to bring back our freedoms and our liberties.
Thanks, Red. You know, one of the first commandments we ever got from our Creator that shows up in Scripture is the commandment to subdue, to take dominion. I personally have come to the decision that one of the most important things that we can do in order to defend our the rights that, that our Father in Heaven has given us is to learn the common law, to restore our knowledge of the common law, and to use it in the defense of our rights. I asked you a question, Gus, a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to ask it again now, and I'd like for you to spend a little time on this one, if you can. And that is, if a small percentage of the people knew and were able to use the common law, what difference would it make to us locally, statewide, and across the states?
The primary impact I believe it would have is if you know, if you know that people around you understand the law and understand their rights to be let alone, I think you'll have more respect for your community. And the lack of respect in our communities is a really big problem because nobody's held accountable. So you know, it would lead to a lot more accountability. And as that grew, as the knowledge of the common law, or what we, you know, there's a lot of, we talk about common law, and that's not the English common law, it's not the American common law, it's what was created long before this country, at least that's what I'm talking about, the stuff that that was written about, the way the Connecticut government and the Massachusetts government came together in the 1640s with a specific mandate to create law according to the mind of God as revealed in His Word. You know, that's the common law I'm talking about, where you're talking about the law that is common to all men. So as people learn that law, they will have a whole lot more respect for their fellow man. You know, crime rates would go down. The accountability in government, small government, larger government, states, counties, and so on, you know, it always comes back to the same thing. Somewhere in that government, there's a corrupt individual, and accountability would cause the man who was harmed by that corrupt man in office to be able to hold him accountable. So, you know, once you start holding a man or a woman accountable that's in an official position for causing you harm or injury, the people in these positions would have a whole lot more respect for the rest of us. And it doesn't have to be nasty. I was talking to somebody about Common Core, and you know, it used to be No Child Left Behind. Now it's Common Core. And, you know, and they keep manipulating the educational system, and a lot of people complain and whine about that. But if you were able to put a claim in and show that your child was harmed, then you know, you put a suit in. Let's say it's only for $180, or for $360, or let's say you put a suit in and you say, look, you know, you pay your teachers $100 or $200 a day to be here and teach, you know, these kids, or you get $100 a day for each kid rather to teach them. You know, I want that $100 a day. I'm going to teach my own kid because I don't like what you guys are doing. You're causing harm to my kid. And if every teacher, every man or woman that felt that way about Common Core did that, you know, if they sued the school system, sued the state, you know, for a small amount of money, you know, maybe 20 or 30 people in the community, you know, and they charged them, you know, they sued them for $180. I mean, the fact that they did it would really, really resonate. And, you know, there's just a lot you can do when you have accountability. And naturally that would flow up to the Federation of States that we call the United States. So it could have a very big impact, but it starts in the family. It starts with shutting the TV off. It starts with books like, you know, the Uncle Remus stories and things that teach integrity and respect for your fellow man. And if you don't have that, it's never going to work its way up to the top.
Well, our courts have been consumed and occupied by the judiciary and the Bar Association, all of which are basically now operating as corporate structures, as legal fictions. Our school systems have been taken over by tax exempt foundations. You know, our agriculture and everything is all now just really corporately controlled, and the corporations are primarily controlled by the banksters. They've now, you know, basically brain soiled, as Red calls it. Every one of us, from the time we were born, you know, I'm 63 years old, and I've had to come to the decision that most of what I've been told throughout my life by our media, by our information systems, by education, certainly through the false history that we've been taught, I've just been lied to a lot. And that control has, you know, has consumed us to the point of almost destroying our republic. Common law due to that control, those control mechanisms, if people knew how to use it.
Well, to which control mechanisms? The corporations?
Yeah, the legal fictions. All the control that they put on individuals to enslave them,
okay.
It seems insurmountable, but one man, just even one man, much less a small group of people, knowing the common law, seems to take a stand against that and fully capable of defeating it.
The roots of our government, the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Okay, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So it's to secure these rights to property that governments are created, to secure property, to protect property, to preserve it. And when you have a corporation, IBM or Verizon or any company, that's out there, they are an extension of that government. Their primary function is to secure, protect, and preserve the property of a man, period. There's no exceptions to that. And when a corporation harms a man, their corporate charter is on the line. So it's a very risky thing. The problem is people don't know what to do about it. They don't know how to act as a man in court and hold that corporate entity accountable for the harm that they're doing to a man. And a lot of times, there's people that are complaining. You know, they're complaining about the education system. They're complaining about stuff, and complaining doesn't do any good. You have to show that there's a harm. So you can't go into court complaining. You have to go into court with an actual loss, an actual injury, an actual harm that you can show and prove in court. And once you have that, now you have accountability on your side. So, it depends on what the circumstances are, but most of the stuff we talk about is complaining. It's people that just complain. They write letters. As you know, I was very much involved with the redress petitions here in New Hampshire, and I still believe that that should exist for the general public. But, you know, you're petitioning to what is the legislature, which is the higher entity, as far as the government's concerned. But as a man, you shouldn't be petitioning them. You should let them know this is what happened. There was a harm done. It was done by that man over there, that company, that corporation. And it is, my right to have redress. So we're going to have a hearing, and I'm going to present my case to the legislature. It should not be optional. You're not petitioning for a hearing. And things like that need to change. So that's what I was working on before, and what I learned from studying this stuff, the common law stuff, is that there's a better way to get redress. And so that's why I started the other website, Redress for Dummies. .org is as a just to get foundational information out to people so they can start, and then they can go from there and learn more. But you know, one of the real big problems is people do too much complaining. They don't stake a claim. They don't profess their claim in open court. They just complain.
Well, there's been a lot of misconception out there, and let me back up for just a second. You know, if you look at the redress side of this, what we found is that the formal petitions that have been filed, We the People Foundation and Bob Schultz and them were a good example of that. They repeatedly, you know, 15, 20 times, they went in and filed formal petitions of grievance were under constitutional violations to the government. And I'm getting a lot of scratching sound. I'm not sure where that's coming from. But every time they put in a petition for grievance, it was completely ignored. And we've seen the judiciary and the rules of civil and criminal procedure have basically written out any petition into the courts by the people on constitutional issues. They just say you don't have standing. So people started saying, well, we need common law courts. And they tried to figure out a way to create what they thought was a common law court. And now, after several years of digging into this, and really Carl and people like that, and George Gordon and some others, Bill Thornton, and now yourself, showing people how you can take the common law into any court of record, this is a new doorway for most people, and it wipes out all of those phony you don't have standing kind of arguments, and provides a path, and if people were to learn this, and we were to start seeing it all over the place, where a lot of people bringing their petitions now by way of a it's going to just shake their tree, isn't it?
Well, the people would not be bringing in petitions. They'd be bringing in claims. And to go.
Well, I understand. I understand. My point is, yeah, is that we've been going around about it in all the wrong way. And now we've got a way that they can't ignore.
Well, like I said, our government is created to secure, protect, and preserve property. That's the foundation of our government. Our entire court system is based on that. If you have been harmed, if you've been injured, if you've had a loss, then you are a man or a woman aggrieved, and nobody has a higher standing in that court than that man who seeks remedy, who seeks redress, because that is the function of our government. So when that man goes to court and acts like a man, not like a pro se, not like a plaintiff, but acts like a man. He makes a claim. He doesn't represent himself. He presents himself. He presents his case to the jury, and he makes his claim. He stakes his claim right there in court, and nothing supersedes that. If you look at the language in I just got a court decision from a lady I'm helping out, and in the court decision it said that the father complains about something through his attorney who proffers, and the woman testifies to these particular things because she was there as herself and demanded to be sworn in before she started. So she's testifying, and the man is complaining through his attorney who's proffering. You know, think about the difference between the woman who's giving testimony, and it could be a man, it doesn't matter, you know, but you've got one man testifying and another man complaining. That's the difference between common law. Because, you know, she was moving in common law, and he was moving in statutes in the same courtroom during the same hearing. And the court right now, it's funny to see the paperwork that's going from side to side. The attorney's actually asking the court how she's supposed to handle the responses to this lady's paperwork, because she's acting in common law and the attorney is asking the court, do I have to recognize that paperwork? Because if I answer her paperwork, then I'm admitting that it's true, that it's lawful paperwork. And she doesn't want to admit that. And she's actually asking the court, the court's permission to not answer. So it's pretty neat to see how it all, you know, it all works itself out. But there's obviously some line that that attorney does not want to cross.
Well, you and Carl, I've heard you both talk about moving your claim in the court. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that means, to move your claim in the court?
All right. There's when we talk, we typically talk about filing your own case. You go to the courthouse and you put a claim. For instance, a claim might be, I, a man, claim that John Doe trespassed upon property by way of something, you can say robbery, theft, forgery. So, you know, that would be the claim. And then you would put the exhibits in. There'd be more than that. You have to have a remedy. But that's basically the claim. You know, you get two parties, there's a cause of action, and there's evidence submitted, and that's it. That's the claim. So typically one page is fine, covers everything. I put one in today, and I wanted to keep it on one page, so I went and got some 8.5 by 14 paper, because when you write the claim out by hand, it's hard to keep it real, real small. So there was plenty of room left at the bottom. I just needed an extra 1/2 inch or so. And that's the claim that we typically talk about. But this past Monday, I was in court with a lady, and she wanted to put her claim in, and they told her that in that court, they don't do trials by jury. So she put it in. Instead of filing her own claim, it was a last-minute thing. She put it in as she just put it into the case. And when they announced the case, she came up and she talked about what she wanted to get done with this claim, and the judge told her, you can't put a claim into this building. You know, you're going to have to do that in the other courthouse down the street at Superior Court. He says, did you mean to put in a counterclaim? And she said, no, I'm a woman. I have to, you know, put in a claim. And the judge, you know, repeated himself and said, well, you're going to have to go down the street and do a, you know, do your claim over there. And he started writing, and he looks up and he says, you said, you know, you're sure you don't want to do this as a counterclaim, correct? And she turned around and looked at me, and I was like, yes, go with the counterclaim. He was putting up the roadblock and saying, detour, to the left. So he was guiding her along, and she wasn't catching it. And then she told him, yeah, I'll do it as a counterclaim. So, you know, even though she was in their court, it was still her claim that was in their court. It was a counterclaim. So the attorney went first. He proffered and put his case forward. And then when it came for her claim, the judge told her to raise her right hand. She swore in, and then she professed her claim, and she, you know, she gave testimony of how it actually was. So typically, I mean, this is a pretty, you know, simple case. Typically, you get a decision, you know, a week or two. The judge said it was going to take them 5 to 6 weeks because she's claiming $20 a day for stress and anxiety, because they filed this thing back in May, and she wants $20 a day until the hearing, which was on Monday. So she's looking for just over $2,000 from the attorney for barratry. You know, she didn't go after the company that the attorney represents. She went after the attorneys for moving a false claim with no firsthand knowledge, with nothing. And the attorney who showed up was not one of the attorneys that was supposed to be there. There were two attorneys. She had been mailing them questions that she wanted answered so she can get ready for court. She had sent out 3 letters, one in June, one in July, one in August, and they never answered. And right before court, she had put in something that said she was looking for some cash for compensation for the stress. So these two attorneys didn't show up. Some other attorney showed up. I happen to know this guy. He's a nice guy, and he's actually the former county prosecutor in our town. He's a decent guy. So the case got started, and he had not filed his appearance. And halfway through the case, when she started testifying, she testified that this man was not, he had no capacity to even be here and speak in the case. And the judge made him file his appearance right there in court, stopped everything, made him file his appearance, and then she objected to everything he had said, and they continued. And it was just a really neat hearing, but there was a lot of times. And she was mellow. She was calm. It wasn't her first time in court, but it's her first time common law, so she was thinking of the different scenarios. And there was many times where the judge said, I can't do that, or she objected to something and he overruled her. So he put up this roadblock, but meanwhile, he would give her hints. There was these little hints, like detour to the right, detour to the left, you can't go this way, but, and he would give certain words and to test her out, to see little roadblocks to see if she knew her stuff, because she was acting in common law. And when she got stopped and she was just wondering which way to go, she wasn't sure, he would say a word or two, and she would just, you could see the wheels going around, and she was pondering, and then she'd move forward. She was able to figure her way through. So it was really, really neat to see such an awesome judge in a scenario like that, instead of steamrolling over the woman, because if she was a defendant, it would have been all over. I mean, she would have never even had a chance to present her claim. And he allowed her to proceed, to say everything she had to say, and to do it in a manner that was really respectful. And I thought it was fantastic to have an opportunity to see that. But that's not what we typically talk about with a claim. What we're talking about when we do a claim is in common law, you're the moving party, where you actually go first and you speak your claim and you lay down all the testimony, and then the other side has a chance to defend themselves. But, so those are the two ways you can go with a claim.
What does that do to the status, jurisdiction, or authority of the judge when you move your own claim in the court?
When you move your own claim in the court, if you're moving, for instance, in this case, her claim said that she was a woman, and that she did not understand legalese or the customs of the legal society. And there was enough in there to let the judge know that he was dealing with somebody who was not speaking in legalese, but somebody who was speaking in common English, and that there was a woman present, somebody who was the creator of government, if you go that far. But that's, he played his role perfectly well. He cannot give legal advice to either side. He's supposed to be a referee. However, his job is to treat the persons that are in court. If you're in court in a particular capacity, that's how he's supposed to treat you in that capacity. If you're there in a different capacity, for instance, you might be Uncle Terry to someone, or Cousin Terry to somebody else, and it's a different status that you have. And in court, it's the same way. Depending on your status, you'll be treated differently. And she was obviously in there moving her own claim as a woman, and you could tell the judge was just ripping through people throughout the day. We watched some stuff go through, and she said, I couldn't believe how nice he was to me after all these other people. And it was neat. It just made a really big difference. What technical difference did it make? I think it just comes down to that. There was a woman in court. It wasn't a defendant. It certainly wasn't a complainant. She wasn't putting a complaint in against the other side. It wasn't a cross complaint. It was a their cross claim?
When you're writing that claim, and it's and you might want to talk a little bit about the importance of writing that claim, but also can you give us some of the key elements that that you would want to include in your written claim?
Okay. Let me just pull one up. Oops.
While you're looking at that, I'll remind our callers, we've got a lot of folks that are on our switchboard again this week, and just want to remind you, if you've got a question, you need to hit a 1 on your touchpad there in order to raise your hand to me to let me know that you do have a question. The phone lines are open, and we welcome callers and questions tonight, so please feel free to hit a 1, and we'll get your question in. Also, I believe we're simulcasting tonight with Crusade Radio, and so we got Jim Cook and Doug Millar, who's out there listening at the moment. Guys, if you want to raise your hand, I hope you can hit a 1 and do so. Don't see a 540 yet on our switchboard, but I've been watching for that, Gus, just so you know. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm looking at a claim here that we put in yesterday, I believe. And so, you know, it's got the heading. It's the man's court. His name is, you know, for instance, Smith. It's the Smith Court at the Superior Courthouse of this county. And then there's the case number, which in this case is, you know, it says case number with an underline going across where they're going to write in the case number once it comes out. And then there's the claim, trespass. The type of claim is a trespass, and the type of trespass is a forgery. So it says the next line is prosecutor. You know, the two parties, who are you talking about? Well, one of them is the prosecutor. Whoever's going to be moving the case is the prosecutor. In this case, it's I, a man. And, who, you know, if you want to know who that man is, you look at the cover sheet. The wrongdoer is, in this case, a particular bank. And then next line down, it says, I, a man, require court of record, trial by jury, separated by semicolons. And you can see Carl's paperwork on his website, broadmind.org. If you go there, you click on a tab that says documents, and he's got about 15 of the 40 or so that he put into a particular case listed there. And this is, you know, the format that I'm using here. So the next section is I, a man, claim. And so in this case, I own all property at this particular location. This particular bank does cause harm to I, a man, and injury to property by way of forgery. The next bullet point is I wish to settle all verifiable claims to said property that are true, post-due, and owing. And that's it. So, you know, this is what you're claiming what you believe. The next line on this particular thing is, I believe no man or woman by the name of this bank name will ever come to court to verify under oath or affirmation that any claim made by this particular bank is true, due, and owing. So the next section that goes down is, what is it you're looking for? Well, I wish, order, and require this bank to cease and desist all actions which interfere with my rights to this property, and I wish that to be reflected in the county registry of deeds, and I wish for, you know, wish, order, and require, these are just bullet points, compensation equivalent to the amount of this property which they're trying to steal from me as, you know, eye for an eye. This property, let's say, is was $200,000. Well, you're trying to steal my property worth $200,000. I want in return the same amount for, you know, as compensation for what you're trying to do to me. And I say here, and we'll verify in open court that all herein be true. That's the, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in my document. That kind of a, under the penalties of perjury statement. So the next line is a forgiveness clause. You know, I'm willing to forgive those who trespassed against me if they're willing to, as I wish those who trespassed, that I trespass upon. I'm trying not to read what I've actually got, but just to give people an idea. I will forgive those who trespassed against me as I would wish those that I trespass upon to forgive my debts. And so that's basically the whole claim. There's the claim itself, which is in this case three sentences, and then there's a statement of belief. You know, this is what I believe in this case, and then what your compensation, what your remedy is going to be to cure the trespass. And that's pretty much it. You know, this entire claim is on a page with about an inch left at the bottom of the page.
I'd like to try something here, and Red, I need your permission here to do this. I'll seek permission instead of forgiveness. I know forgiveness is easier to get than permission, but Red, you've got a case that you'd like to bring forward. I'd kind of like to hear, if you were willing, Red, for you to tell Gus or our listeners how you plan to approach, professing your claim, and exactly how you want to approach that going at the court. And I'd like for Gus to offer his suggestions about how he might do it differently, of whether there's something that he hears that maybe might be a problem or create a problem, or what he might suggest that would enhance that case. Red, are you open for that kind of little exercise?
Can you hear me?
We hear you loud
yep.
and clear.
Yeah. My situation, of course, in Montana is different because I have been, 20 years since I sued that federal judge in Montana. And the case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court the first week of August of 1996. And then the Solicitor General, in December of 96, noticed all the parties to the action that I was correct in what I was saying in my complaints against the judge, and that he was not going to oppose me. Well, now, if you've got that kind of history life and what you're doing, your activities, it makes a difference in everything that comes down. After I had sued the judge, the IRS tried to intimidate me, as they had been trying for 25 years, I guess, or so. And of course, they put a lien and a seizure on a very expensive piece of property, really. It was a commercial acreage right on an interchange on Interstate 90. In Montana, and they were trying to intimidate me and get me to back off. Well, that was 94, and I had an attorney file the action. I gave him the paperwork, but at that time I was on these speaking tours. I was very rarely home, and I had to have somebody that could monitor the case, because I knew that they would wait for an opportunity to where I was in some place like Philadelphia, clear across the country or up in New Hampshire, and they would schedule a hearing where I could no way make it, and so I had to have an attorney. Well, when the case was docketed against the federal judge with the U.S. Supreme Court, it had a real shock effect on the Internal Revenue Service. And so I had filed that quiet title action. I had the lawyer file it, and which I didn't want to do. The lawyer, of course, he was a friend of mine, and he was a good, very good trial attorney. But when I had him do it, he said, "Red, you can't win this. They're going to really be on this case." And I said, "That's all right. Just you do what I tell you." I paid him up front, and so he couldn't complain. So he finally filed the action. I had given him the paperwork to file. And so anyway, when that case was docketed against the federal judge in August of 96, the lawyer, I was out of town, and the lawyer, he got a phone call from the district counsel of the Internal Revenue Service, and he told the lawyer, he said, "We've got to settle this case. We've got to get this case cleared up." And the lawyer come at him, he was totally out of the loop, and he said, "Well, what's going on here?" And the district counsel said this. He said, "We are going to have a very bad precedent coming down." And as a result of this, the Internal Revenue Service had a different respect. They understood that what I had done against the federal judge, that was common law. And they grasped the fact that this quiet title action that I'd had the lawyer file was going to get hammered on this too. And of course, I've got this other advantage in that I am the co-author of the book, The Law That Never Was. I am the guy that started, I was the spark that started the Montana people researching the fraud of the 16th Amendment in 1980. And so the IRS and the district council, they were all shook up. Anyway, as it was, I ended up, we wrote out what it would take to settle, and I got $145,000 out of them. Now, how many people have gotten $145,000 out of the Internal Revenue Service? It was my money, of course, but they had no intention of ever letting somebody like me get my money back. And a lot depends on what you do. And I think that in the case that Terry is talking about, I have planned on this, and it's going to be a very difficult situation because of my being in Washington State, and I want to file it in Montana, and it has to do with my brother, one of my brother's estate, because I am the court-appointed administrator of my brother's estate, and he has a conflict or a controversy with the state of Montana and the Internal Revenue Service, and so it's a little bit complicated in that regard. So when I file this action, if I get it filed, the first thing in that complaint, it's going to be common law, of course, and because there's not going to be an attorney involved. And any time you go as a non-attorney and such, it's not very difficult to maintain the status of a common law case. And so I'm going to list the authorities under which I am filing this action. And, of course, I will use the First Amendment right to petition for redress of grievance, and I will use the Seventh Amendment right to a Seventh Amendment common law jury trial of this, and then I'm going to put in a judicial notice. A judicial notice is a very, very effective tool, and I would really recommend that anybody that's thinking about filing a common law case consider filing a judicial notice right in the beginning, before you really go into the body of the complaint. And you file a judicial notice and put the judge on notice that, and of course, this I'm talking about a case where the where there's money involved that the government is taken control of in one way or another, and so you want to put the judge on notice that he has a very serious conflict of interest in this matter, in this controversy, because he is a beneficiary of the tax laws of this country, of that Congress had the tax laws, you know, passed by the Congress and such. Anyway, he's a beneficiary because he is paid from tax money, and this goes for every judge, every public servant in the entire governmental system. They all take the oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. They are all beneficiaries of the tax laws because that's where their salary comes from. And so you put them on notice that they are not going to have the authority or the power to make any findings of fact or conclusions of law in this controversy. And this just cuts them off at the pass. They, I haven't seen a case yet where it didn't have the effect of basically, you know, stopping them in their tracks. If you do get into trial, of course, you can subpoena the government agents that are involved in this controversy, and you can bring them in and have them sworn in under oath. And I'll tell you, you're not going to get a one of them that's going to jeopardize himself in any way. You're going to get the truth. It's going to be the truth all the way. And like in my case, where I have standing in the court, and they can't deny me that because of the fact that I am the co-author of the book, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1, and I was very much a part of that process. And so it's the kind of situation. Of course, I'm putting the complaint in the form of an affidavit, and there will be a copy of the title page, oath or judicial notice, and the affidavit that will be the main body of the complaint. Each one of the 12 people on that jury are going to get a copy of that, and there isn't going to be a judge say, no, you can't do that. The statute says something, or the judicial practices says something or other. That doesn't count. He's not going to do that because of that judicial notice. And so you can give each and every one of the jury a copy of your authorities, your lawsuit, and you're the authorities to have that action filed, and you have the juror, each and every one of them, has a copy of it, and they can take it home with them. If they adjourn the trial for the day and to come back the next day, they can take it home with them or whatever, because the judge cannot invoke rules of the court and such because of his conflict of interest. And when he knows that there's an awareness of his conflict of interest, a strong awareness, he is not going to take a chance, because they know what happened to Judge Batten, the senior federal judge in Montana, when I sued him. And the Solicitor General said I was correct, and that therefore he was not going to oppose me. And so I've probably gone a little longer than I should have here. But I think that there's a tremendous opportunity to make some corrections in our political system here at this point in time. And, of course, there's one thing that I want to mention kind of off the side of what I was talking about here. I think we need to really remember very much as we're processing all this thought, all this ideas and such, remember that our Heavenly Father set down some law, common law, the first and second commandments tell us that our Heavenly Father is the only real God, and there's a lot of small g gods out there. And in the second commandment, of course, he tells us that he's a jealous God. And of course, this is what brought down the USSR, and it's brought down a lot of empires and kingdoms, because governments have a tendency to try to become as small g gods, and they think that they can break the laws that our capital G God has put in place. And
I think you've thrown a lot at Gus here. I think you need to let him kind of get in and make sure he's clear on what he understands your approach is.
Yeah, because I think I just think that we need to have this in the back of our minds, that our Heavenly Father is going to, it isn't going to be a formal complaint. He's just going to put them out of business. And that's what happened to the USSR, and I think there's a high probability. And that's why I said that if I file this action, it will be because the system is still in power. If it's gone, then I'm not going to file it, because we're going to have a different system develop. And that's all I'll have to say for now.
Well, Red, this I'm not sure what the action is and what you're trying to accomplish. You're saying that you're doing this on behalf of your brother. What is the action, and what is the harm that has been done? What is the injury?
The harm was they put liens. They put false liens on our properties, mine and my brother's both. And they really stuck themselves, they really got themselves in trouble with this because there was no due process, no constitutional due process or everything. And it started with the state of Montana rather than the feds. But the feds and the state of Montana Department of Revenue are working arm in arm, and so the action, as near as I'm the decision I've made so far, is that I will start the action in state court, and then call in the IRS agents and such, bring them in as witnesses to where their testimony will hang them out to dry. That's the idea.
So the intent is to get the liens removed from the properties.
Right, right.
Okay. And I'm very familiar with the process that you were explaining and some of the complications that are there. And the reason I have embraced this particular view that I've recently come across is because of its simplicity. And one of the things I taught my children and other people that are stressed out with life is, yeah, at some point in your life, you had some peace on the inside. And when you find that peace again, do whatever it takes to hold on to it. And a lot of that comes by keeping things really, really simple. When things get complex, people get stressed out, they lose their peace. And I have, I've always had a hard time concentrating on complex issues, so when I finally understand them, I really, really understand them, because it took me forever to get them. So I really appreciate it. I've come to appreciate a much simpler way of doing things. And in this particular case, I would say that you can file a claim against whoever it is that has these liens for forgery. You can do it in your local district court, and you can have the wrongdoers, you can file this claim against these, you know, two or three actors, these wrongdoers, but you would do it against the man in who's acting in that capacity, not the IRS agent, but you would do it against Bob, Frank, and Jim, whoever it is that put these liens in. And, you know, in common law, your claim would be very simple. It would be, you know, I, a man, claim Bob, Frank, and Jim, and you would do three separate claims, one for each one. So, you know, Bob causes trespasses upon property by way of forgery. And you would have a preliminary hearing set up. You'd let the clerk know what the court rules are. You would tell the clerk that you require the clerk to appoint, or it's not appoint, I forget what the word I use is. But anyway, you know, to put a magistrate on the case that is skilled in common law, and to schedule a preliminary hearing. And the man, Bob, is being accused. He needs to come in, and he needs to produce the evidence that supports why he should not be charged a certain fee to compensate you for the stress. And that's it. That's the whole case. So he would have a preliminary hearing, and if he doesn't show up, you issue a warrant, you have him arrested, you have him brought in so that you can make sure he gets due process and has a chance to face his accuser, and you spell out the case. And if he decides to plead the fifth and remain silent, well, he had his chance, and you write the order for the magistrate to witness and to put through the clerk's office so that the clerk can witness it, and with the aid of the sheriff, you can have this lien removed from the property. And that's pretty much it. There's really not a whole lot to it. In common law, you make the rules of the court. For instance, one of the rules in my court is legalese is grounds for contempt. Real simple rule. Don't be using that Black's Law language in my court. Okay, this is my court. Every man has a right to hold his court in that public building. So I go in, I pay my fee like everybody else. I want to use a room just like everybody else. I want the aid of the, you know, the magistrate and the clerk to witness the truthfulness of my paperwork, of my claim, and to witness it for me so that I can get my, you know, so I can be on my way and just move on with my life. So the simplicity of that is it's always your court. You're always under control. Nobody writes an order without your consent. And if the man Bob comes in and does not produce a claim, I mean, produce the evidence to show that it's not a forgery, it's all done. You know, that has to be gotten rid of. It has to be removed from your property. On the other hand, if the man comes in and says, well, I have this evidence and this evidence and this evidence, then you move forward to a trial by jury where you would actually go through the whole trial and let the jury make those decisions. And you would live by the determination of the jury. So you would put your claim in before the jury, give the jury all the facts of what actually happened, and then the man, Bob, who put the lien on there, would have a chance to defend himself. And the jury would make a decision, and it would be final. And that would be it. The judge is only there to make sure that the rules that you set up in the case are followed. The law of the case is whatever you put the law in. For instance, if I get arrested for forgery, they're going to say that it was statute such and such. You know, New Hampshire, it's RSA 633:4 or whatever the number would be. And when you did your case in common law, you'd simply say the law of the case is forgery, as found in Deuteronomy, you know, wherever the law is for this particular case. So it would be a man moving the case according to the word of God, and the jury makes the final decision according to the Seventh Amendment, and it's final, it's not appealable, and it's all done.
I didn't mention the fact that, and I should have, that my thinking as going into the state court, there are probably hundreds, perhaps thousands even, of income tax cases. The Law That Never Was, Volume 1, came out in April of 1985. It'll be 30 years. It's coming up this next year in April. And there have been numerous cases where people have tried to use the 16th Amendment fraud, the failure to have it properly ratified. The evidence is so overwhelming. And they've tried to use it, and they've been beat up in the courts because they're always defended by lawyers, and lawyers and the judges will make sure you lose. And so we don't have any case law in 30 years. We don't have any case law, and we've had the judges admit that they are more or less instructed. They are not to let these cases go where the 16th Amendment ratification is questioned. This is why I'm going into the state court, and this is why I'm going at it the way I am, because I suspicion that the state of Montana they'll get some instructions from the IRS and the federal courts are probably very quick to hurry up and get rid of those liens and not let this go to trial. And of course, here I am coming up 86 here shortly, and that would probably be easier on me in some respects. However, after spending as much time and as much money as I have over the years on this 16th Amendment question, I really want to see it go to a 7th Amendment common law jury and see what happens then. I don't know if you're aware of the federal judge, district judge in North Carolina that made the statement in open court, and I've got the transcript of that case where he says that he has examined some of this evidence on the 16th Amendment, and he's convinced that it was not ratified, but he says there's no court in the land that's going to do that. So it has to be a common law jury that's going to handle this. And there probably isn't anybody that's better equipped to do it than I, even with the disadvantage of the age, my age and all of that. But that's the thing in my case. And of course, we've used help people with traffic cases using the common law, and it's just been, man, there's no trial. I mean, it's it's a lead pipe cinch that you're going to get yourself out of the jam that they put you in. If you use the common law, and especially, I think that this nailing them with their conflict of interest is really something that really puts the federal or these judges, whether it's a local traffic court judge or whoever, it puts a real scare into them. So I'm just so excited about what you're saying, because we need people to do all these, what some might consider as minor cases. But I can assure you that any time you go into court with a common law case, and if you win, the word goes out in the system very rapidly. And they start studying, and of course I think that if you remind them of the fact that this government that we have today that's trying to play God, that it could go down and go down very quickly overnight, just like this the USSR did. And what are they going to do? What are all of these judges, especially the federal, what are they going to do? What are they going to do when? When the government goes down, boy, they're in a heap of trouble.
So, of course they are. But, getting back to the to what you were just saying earlier, the conflict of interest with the judge. There is no conflict of interest with the judge, because the judge is only there to testify to the truthfulness of your claim. As far as the IRS agents testifying, they don't have any firsthand knowledge. So if you don't allow them to proffer, to speak except under oath, what are they going to testify to? They pull up a paper. They say, "Look, this is your case. This is your transcript. This is your paperwork. Whatever it is, there's not a man alive that can take the stand and verify the truthfulness of any piece of paper brought into court by the IRS. Period. There is no truthfulness there. There's no man that can verify that information was not messed with. These IRS agents can't do it either." There's nobody that can do that. So I'm a man. I'm saying that I don't owe anybody anything. And if you say that if you're an IRS agent and you believe that I owe anything, then write me a bill that you believe is true, due, and owing, and sign it, give it to me, and tell me that that's what I owe, and I'll pay the bill. And the reason that you're never going to get an IRS agent that's going to do that is because they know, they have no idea how that number got on that paper. They're never going to say anything. So that's what it comes down to. I'm a man. I'm telling you what I believe, and our country is founded on the principle that you can believe what you wish to believe, and that nobody can make you act according to something that you do not believe in. So that's really what it comes down to. It's about who's going to come forward and change my beliefs. You're dealing with another man. Underneath that IRS agent suit is a man. And that man, in common law, is bound by the principles of the common law. And he's not protected. He's got no immunity. So giving you a bill of the exact number that you owe, you're not getting that from the IRS agent. You're getting that from the woman sitting there with a pen in her hands writing it out. So it can be much simpler. And as far as setting case law and precedent for everybody else, you're only setting precedent in their system. You're never going to be setting precedent in common law, because in common law there's no records. Okay, the case comes in, the case does its thing, the case is done. They don't keep records of that. They seal those cases and put them away so nobody can find them. So you're not going to ever get a precedent in common law. But you know, drawing out the man, pulling him out of his uniform and making him stand before God and man as another man, not, you know, as some creation of government, is where it's at in common law. You still there, Red?
Well, yeah, I'm here, Gus. I'm just wondering again. I think our listeners need to very clearly understand why certain testimony is not allowed under common law. You touched on it, but I believe that some additional elaboration on that would be helpful.
All right. It's not only common law. It's anywhere. You know, anywhere that when you're testifying, you're speaking about the truthfulness of something. You swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And here you are, you know, they ask you a question and you proclaim to know the truth. You don't know the truth. Only God knows the truth. All you've got is what you believe. You don't have the truth. And so when you stand up there and you start talking, you're actually professing a belief. That's not the truth. And if you're holding a piece of paper, which is, you know, what else are they going to have? They weren't there. They didn't see you at your job working, earning the money. They didn't see you, you know, the inheritance or whatever. I mean, they've got no firsthand knowledge about anything. And all that goes through these courts is paper. So every dot of ink that's on that piece of paper has to be verified by a man with firsthand knowledge about every single word that's on there. The word the word as, the number, the dollar sign, the parentheses, everything has to be verified by that man. It's impossible to do if you're not the man who created the document. And if you are the man who created the document, where did you get that information? You got it secondhand. It's hearsay. It's just absolutely impossible for these people to provide actual testimony. And in a statutory court, the judge will allow it. You can say that you object, and he's going to overrule you. But the rules of testimony, the law of testimony, is still the same. If it ain't first-hand knowledge, it's not testimony, it's hearsay. So in common law, in a common law court, if the man is offering hearsay, he's lying. He's not telling the truth. And there is no paper that stands in common law. In common law, if you can't verify that paper with your mouth and explain every detail of it and why you know it's the truth, then you're out of luck. So there's not a whole lot of wiggle room with that kind of a process.
I want to reiterate to anyone that's listening on the phone, if you would like to ask a question or have another case you'd like to bring here and see what Gus's suggestions are, hit a 1 on your phone so that I can know that you've got a question and we'll give you a live mic. Red, did you get anything out of that would help you?
Well, I got to unmute here.
You're unmuted. You may have just muted yourself.
I think you muted yourself, Red.
Yeah, how's that? Can you hear me now?
There you are. You're live. We hear you. I'm just
well,
curious.
I've been through so much of that in the past, and I haven't gotten into this is what I appreciate about Carl, what he's saying and what he's doing, because most of what I have done, you see, has been like in the tax court. We've been able to destroy the tax court practically. I mean, it's just really been an easy thing to do with the tax court. But we have to You know, him talking about the lady wanting to get paid for the stress. I've never done anything like that, and I think that's a great deal. I think that is something that, you know, we need this kind of thing going on where people come into the court that they don't have a reputation as being, litigants and all of that, but they come in and they've got a claim that they've been damaged and such. And boy, I'll tell you this: if we had a few thousand of these happening around the country, it would have a whale of an impact. And I like the idea. Anything that has an impact on the system, I'm all for it.
Red, one of the things, if you're going to proceed in your case the way you're talking about, one of the things that will destroy their case is they claim that based on this law and this law and this law, this code, that statute, that there's a debt, and you know they base all their stuff on codes and statutes. Well,
yeah.
those codes are not law. The law is actually in the Library of Congress under lock and key, and a company called Thompson's out of Canada actually goes there, and they look at the law, and they interpret it into code. And so what you're looking at is an interpretation, you know, what these IRS agents are talking about is an interpretation from some French company, some Canadian company, and it's not the law at all. So that, you know, if they want to say this is the law, then bring in the law. Put it here in front of me, the one that's signed by the members of Congress, and show me where that law applies to Red Beckman.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you, I'm firm in my convictions that there isn't anybody in the federal government, and for a certain extent, people in the state and county and city governments, I think there's pretty much a general conviction that the system cannot survive continuing to operate as they are, that it's the whole system is going to collapse of its own weight, and when I have a chance to talk to somebody, a government employee, I don't care what level they are, when I talk to them, I say, now tell me, do you really think that this system can survive all of this criminal activity that is taking place? They all know there's criminal activity. They all know that they're taking advantage of people that have been dumbed down on purpose, intentionally by the powers that be, and they all know that, and they know that these people are being taken advantage of, and so I just think that the whole thing is... the whole system is corrupt from, and it's going to collapse one of these days, and I just think it's not too far away.
It's not too far away. One of the things that would really help people is if they understood that they're not a person. They're a man. They're a woman. And they need to act accordingly and not take on the assumption, not assume any titles like defendant, that they are not, all these titles that people take, is just a burden. And the language that we use in common law is also extremely important. One of the words that people really misunderstand is argue. If a judge says, "Are you arguing with me?" he's not asking you, are you giving me a hard time? Argue means to polish, to shine, so that you can see through a complicated thing, you know, so that you can see through a situation, to polish the glass so you can see through it clearly to the other side. So when you're arguing your point, you're making your point clear, and you're defining your point. You're not arguing. But people don't realize that. And there's just the whole language of common law, the actual words and what they actually mean is very important. When a judge talks to you, he's talking to the man and the person. Because you is a joinder. It's a word that involves joinder. So there's a lot of a language. And, you know, we talk about, you know, can the government survive with all this corruption? Well, you know, I'd like to look at it a different way. Why blame the government? Okay, how long can the government, you know, exist when people refuse to get involved, people refuse to figure out how to hold another man acting in that capacity as an IRS agent or whatever they happen to be doing? If they're causing harm or injury, then why not learn how to be a man and hold some other man accountable? And instead of going bowling on Thursdays and Monday night football and Saturdays we get the barbecue, Sundays, you know, we're out on the boat all weekend. You know, it's just, it's ridiculous that people spend all their time on, you know, focused on we have to live and we have to enjoy ourselves and, you know, we have the right to be just, you know, pursue happiness all the time. You know, people are not taking it upon themselves to be responsible. I was teaching redress for 2 years, and it's in our Constitution. It's Article 31. You know, the legislature shall assemble for the redress of public grievances. It's a mandate, and yet, you know, people were not taking advantage of this. They weren't following through. They weren't even interested, you know, because it's not my problem that my next-door neighbor is being threatened by the IRS or being threatened by the building inspector, because my life is just beautiful. And so they don't care about their neighbors. They don't care about nobody but themselves. It's a very selfish society. And I think we're the problem, not so much the government. And we're going to get what we deserve.
We've got three callers with hands up, and we've got about 28 minutes left here, Gus. I think we better get to them if we're going to take some calls, if that's all right. Red, thanks for being our guinea pig for our role play. That was very helpful. I think our listeners got a lot out of that process. Gus, can I bring in a caller?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, area code 480, you have an open mic. What's your question for Gus?
Yes, Gus, this is Ralph, and we have several things that we're working on right now. We have a wrongful foreclosure where the bank has literally kicked us out of our house, gave us an hour to leave when we are now living on our land, unimproved land. I also have a photo radar ticket from 2010, and we are working with the private attorney general on that, which is Jeff Ball. Get that resolved. And we also, the one I really was asking, because you're talking about the IRS, has been stealing money from my Social Security, and I need to know how to move forward on that one also.
Okay. The traffic case, first of all, you were inside your property, and you were relocating it. You were moving your property from here to there.
Correct. I was not driving. I was traveling.
Traveling, a lot of people look at that traveling thing. You're not traveling. Traveling is actually the ability to go from one state to another state without a passport. That's the right to travel.
Okay.
Thank you. And I was there, too. I was looking at that, and I forget where I read up on that about a year ago. But, what it comes down to is you're a man. The government exists to preserve and protect and secure your property. That's it. And you were using your property. You were you were moving your property from one place to another. They cannot tell you, the government cannot tell you what you can do with your property. And that's the foundation of your argument. And anybody who goes against you for doing so is, for one thing, they're bearing false witness against you. You know, another thing is extortion. Okay, the man that is prosecuting the case is saying, you do this or else. Well, that's extortion. So, you know, that's that. The foreclosure, they're using, unless they produced the note, brought the note in, showed the debt, showed an accounting of the account, they're using a forged instrument. And
well, it was in mirrors, so it's been shredded.
Exactly. So it was separated from the land, from the property, and it's an unsecured note. And there's also, but you're never going to win in their court. You know, this is what you need to do in your court. You bring the, first of all, you have to find out if there's any authority for the attorneys to be working on behalf of that bank. Okay, if you don't see a power of attorney that was written out, then those attorneys might have just bought the debt. They might be just third-party debt collectors. So you need to check into that. But if it's the attorneys, then you're talking about barratry. You're talking about them moving a claim that, you know, they're stating that Bank New York Mellon is the moving party when, in fact, they don't have any interest in the property whatsoever. It's just a bunch of attorneys looking to make some money. So, you know, you got to get more into the details. So it's either going to be barratry or forgery or theft by forgery. You got to look into those kinds of things and move your own case against the proper party. You got to find out who that is. The IRS...
Yeah, it sounds like I need to do a judicial notice also on the judge who made the judgment. Is that also correct?
I think a judicial notice is a waste of time because that judge is working in their court with their statutes, with their rules, everything. Okay, when you're in their court, when you agree to be a pro se litigant, a pro se is a man who has a license to act as an attorney in that particular case until it's done. So, you know, you've been given permission by the legal society to be an attorney for the day, you know, that kind of thing. And as a defendant, your role is to walk over and pull the thing off the clothes rack, you know, that says defendant, and put that suit on. And when you look in the mirror and you get the defendant suit on, you realize you look like a pinata. And that's exactly what it is. You're a pro se defendant. You're the man who's going into court to get whooped by the other side. So giving judicial notice that, you know, I don't like being a pinata is not going to get you anywhere. So, you know, take the suit off.
I was talking about actually putting him on notice, you know, a judicial notice, and then filing a claim against him for because of the, you know, and doing it under common law.
Like I said, the judicial notice is a waste of time. What it is this man is a judge. He is acting in his capacity as a judge, this man, and when he's doing that, his job is to treat whoever's in his courtroom according to the role that they are choosing to play. You chose to be the defendant. You didn't file your claim. You didn't go in there as a claimant, as a prosecutor. So if you want to, you know, he's not going to tell you what, you know, he's not going to give you legal advice. He has to be fair to both sides and keep his mouth shut and just treat you according to the role you wish to play. Well, if you wish to play the pinata, he can't tell you, you know, that's it. That's the role you've chosen. So giving him judicial notice is really not going to do any good. On the other hand, somebody is coming after you for this property, and you need to find out, you know, who it is. Is it actually the bank, or is it some third-party debt collector who bought the debt at, you know, 3 cents on the dollar? If even that, I mean, they might have bought it, you know, for pesos on the dollar. So you need to find out who the proper party is and let them know that you are a man. Government does not exist to cause harm to a man, and that they are an extension of government, and certainly they don't want to cause harm to a man. And at this time, your actions are causing harm to a man. And you know, this kind of letter writing begins by writing a simple letter. You know, dear Bob, are you the man I need to talk to about ironing out this problem? And you need to get into this letter writing campaign to, first of all, figure out who it is that you're that has the authority to cause the harm to cease and desist. Once you've identified that man and you've given that man notice, not the judge, you give that man notice, fair warning, that he is causing you harm and that you wish for it to stop. If he does not stop, then you have the right to proceed with a claim. Unless it's, you know, unless it's an emergency. I mean, if somebody's standing on your foot, you know, and you need that man off, then you know, you're not going to write him a letter. You're going to do what you got to do. So, and the IRS is very much the same way. You know, who says I owe this money?
She read her magazine and the moon rose.